The Earth revolves at a brisk 1,041 miles an hour at the equator, though as you move toward the poles, the rate slopes off considerably, to about 600 miles an hour in London or Paris, for instance. The reason for this is self-evident when you think about it. If you're on the equator, the spinning Earth has to carry you quite a distance, about 40,000 kilometers, to get you back to the same spot. If you stand beside the North Pole, however, you may need travel only a few feet to complete a revolution. Yet in both cases, it takes 24 hours to get you back to where you began. Therefore, it follows that the closer you get to the equator, the faster you must be spinning. The Coriolis effect explains why anything moving through the air in a straight line laterally to the Earth's spin will, given enough distance, seem to curve to the right in the northern hemisphere and to the left in the southern as the Earth revolves beneath it. The standard way to envision this is to imagine yourself at the center of a large carousel and tossing a ball to someone positioned on the edge. By the time the ball gets to the perimeter, the target person has moved on and the ball passes behind him. From his perspective, it looks as if it has curved away from him. That is the Coriolis effect, and it is what gives weather systems their curl and sends hurricanes spinning off like tops. The Coriolis effect is also why naval guns firing artillery shells have to adjust to left or right. A shell fired 15 miles would otherwise deviate by about 100 yards and plop harmlessly into the sea. Considering the practical and psychological importance of the weather to nearly everyone, it's surprising that meteorology didn't really get going as a science until shortly before the turn of the 19th century. Though the term meteorology itself had been around since 1626, when it was coined by a T. Granger in a book of logic. Part of the problem was that successful meteorology requires the precise measurement of temperatures, and thermometers for a long time proved more difficult to make than you might expect. An accurate reading was dependent on getting a very even bore in a glass tube, and that wasn't easy to do. The first person to crack the problem was Daniel Gabriel Fahrenheit, a Dutch maker of instruments who produced an accurate thermometer in 1717. However, for reasons unknown, he calibrated the instrument in a way that put freezing at 32 degrees and boiling at 212 degrees. From the outset, this numeric eccentricity bothered some people, and in 1742, Anders Celsius, a Swedish astronomer, came up with a competing scale. In proof of the proposition that inventors seldom get manners entirely right, Celsius made boiling point 0 and freezing point 100 on his scale, but that was soon reversed. The person most frequently identified as the father of modern meteorology was an English pharmacist named Luke Howard, who came to prominence at the beginning of the 19th century. Howard is chiefly remembered now for giving cloud types their names in 1803. Although he was an active and respected member of the Linnaean Society and employed Linnaean principles in his new scheme, Howard chose the rather more obscure Askesian Society as the forum to announce his new system of classification. The Askesian Society, you may just recall from an earlier chapter, was the body whose members were unusually devoted to the pleasures of nitrous oxide. So we can only hope they treated Howard's presentation with the sober attention it deserved. It is a point on which Howard scholars are curiously silent. Howard divided clouds into three groups: stratus for the layered clouds, cumulus for the fluffy ones, the word means heaped in Latin, and cirrus, meaning curled, for the high, thin, feathery formations that generally presage colder weather. To these he subsequently added a fourth term, nimbus, from the Latin for cloud, for a rain cloud. The beauty of Howard's system was that the basic components could be freely recombined to describe every shape and size of passing cloud: stratocumulus, cirrostratus, cumulocongestus, and so on. It was an immediate hit, and not just in England. The poet Johann von Goethe in Germany was so taken with the system that he dedicated four poems to Howard. Howard's system has been much added to over the years, so much so that the encyclopedic, if little read, International Cloud Atlas runs to two volumes. But interestingly, virtually all the post-Howard cloud types, mammatus, bellus, nebulosis, sphissatus, floccus, and mediocris are a sampling, have never caught on with anyone outside meteorology, and not terribly much there, I'm told. Incidentally, the first, much thinner edition of that atlas, produced in 1896, divided clouds into 10 basic types, of which the plumpest and most cushiony-looking was number 9, cumulonimbus. That seems to have been the source of the expression, to be on cloud 9. If you've ever been struck by how beautifully crisp and well-defined the edges of cumulus clouds tend to be, while other clouds are more blurry, the explanation is that in cumulus cloud, there is a pronounced boundary between the moist interior of the cloud and the dry area beyond it. Any water molecule that strays beyond the edge of the cloud is immediately zapped by the